House Committee on Trade and Economic Development. Good afternoon and welcome. Today we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2299. And I'm going to have Kim kind of explain, if she wants to, what it is. Do you want to? No, want to. It's a huge bill. And we're going to start the first of at least two public hearings on this bill because of the length of it. And
Madam Chair, I can make a very, very brief overview of this bill.
She had to type it long.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2299 has a number of components that primarily deal with business development tax incentives in Oregon. I will just quickly outline the sort of major incentives that it deals with are the small city business income tax exemption, strategic investment program, a number of things dealing with enterprise zones, and electronic commerce. And I will defer then to the department, I think, to give you the details of those different.
Thank you, Kim. And the way I understand it, we're just going to take this in pieces and kind of go through it. And committee, as we go through it, if you have questions, just please let me know, because it is a huge bill, and it's going to take a lot of understanding. And I can tell from your questions and stuff, everyone understands all of this stuff. So. Are we going to have Mike Burton and Art Fish? Do they want to come up together? Sure. So we have here. Welcome.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Mike Burton. I'm the Assistant Director of the Economic and Community Development Department. I'm not sure why I'm the lucky winner of the Enterprise Zone, but it's part of my responsibility. The department has been instructed to address only the Enterprise Zone component of this bill today, so I'm prepared to walk you through that. I'm going to do a brief introduction and then go on a section-by-section review of the bill. The Enterprise Zone statute is complicated and very hard to read and get through, as you may have determined. Mm-hmm. It is such because it's been in place for about 15 years and has been amended from time to time to address specific circumstances that have typically created problems for companies. And those companies then had conversations with the legislatures and changes were enacted. It's our belief that the single most important thing we can do to make the program more understandable, easy to administer, is reorder the statute to take care of that piecemeal structure that's in place today. We're not alone in that. In 1999, the department was handed a budget note that suggested we needed to look at administration of the program and figure out ways to make it more cost-effective, which legislative intent we understood by virtue of having been at the hearings to mean that we needed to simplify the administration. We put together a document that became House Bill 2131 for the last session and made some, in addition to reordering the statute, which is our agenda again this time, we made some changes that we thought would simplify the program, eliminated some thresholds and the like. In our eagerness to satisfy the legislature, we made some changes that created fairly significant revenue impacts in that simplification process. That created enough concern with taxing entities that they expressed those concerns at hearings, and because we couldn't work through them in time during the last session, the department withdrew the bill and are essentially offering an improved version this time. By improved, I mean we met with those constituent groups over the interim and believe that we've put together something that has a consensus behind it. Again, the department's agenda is twofold in the Enterprise Zone part of this legislation. They are to reorder the statute and extend a sunset on the long-term rural Enterprise Zone exemption. There are a few substantive changes in the statute or in the bill, but it's not as bad as it appears at first glance. Most of the new text in the bill is simply a reinsertion of a piece that's being removed from somewhere else. So I don't actually think it's going to be that onerous to walk through this part of the bill today. And I thought I would go ahead and do that.
That's fine.
And essentially, it's my intention to point out to you the substantive changes and not to dwell on just the reordering, since those are pieces that are already in the law. The enterprise zone part of the bill begins on page 10. In addition to summary bullets of my testimony, you were given a document that looks like this. This is Art Fish's work. Art Fish is the enterprise zone expert with the department. This is an excellent document. Mr. Fish does excellent work. And it's essentially a crosswalk to the changes in the bill and compares them with the old law. This, again, the first two parts of the bill are not related to enterprise zones per se, so you have to jump to page 3 to follow along. I'm not going to refer to that for the most part as I move ahead, but it's probably much clearer to read Mr. Fish's careful phraseology than my clumsy efforts. I'm going to start in now talking about enterprise zones and House Bill 2299. The first change is that we're bringing all of the definitions to one section. So all of the definitions are included in the part that starts on page 10. There's one change, substantive change in this section, and that is that in the current law there's a term called pre-certification. Pre-certification has been confusing because there's no subsequent certification. People do the pre-certification to essentially put the assessors on notice that they're pursuing an enterprise zone exemption. The term pre-certification means it takes place before construction begins. But we're changing that, or we're proposing to change that, to authorization instead of pre-certification, so that there's no subsequent certification that needs to take place. Another change that takes place in the definitions is reservation enterprise zones are being added in here. Reservation enterprise zones, now these actually, characteristic of the program that was added in the last legislature and was added at the end of the statute, but part of the inclusion in that reservation enterprise zone was that a reservation enterprise zone is a non-urban enterprise zone. So we're proposing to incorporate the relevant parts of a reservation enterprise zone among the other non-urban enterprise zone pieces. So it actually will show up throughout the legislation, but we're just integrating it into the statute, we think, in a more meaningful way. So moving beyond the definitions, the next piece that I'd like to speak to is on page 14. And please interrupt at any time if you have questions. One of the issues in the enterprise zone program now is it is a local election of all of the sponsors of a given zone to choose whether or not to allow the exemption to apply to hotels, motels, destination resorts. That's created an issue specifically in Lincoln County, and we're proposing in this legislation that each of the sponsors would be able to make a different distinction that would be consistent within that jurisdiction. Lincoln City specifically doesn't want to exempt hotels, motels, or destination resorts. They feel like they have enough. But the zone as it exists allows for the exemption to be applied to those facilities. So Lincoln City would be able to make its election, would abide by that election more or less, could actually at one point in time change the election, but essentially would allow for differences across the zone between in that particular election. Another characteristic of the bill that applies in general, but most specifically on pages 16 through 21, which are about management of enterprise zones, is to clarify which of the various entities, the individuals involved in administering the zones, have which responsibilities. And this gets back to the budget note I mentioned, the 99 budget note, where county assessors and the Department of Revenue are participants in the enterprise zone because by law they're required to take certain actions. They're not participants by election or they didn't volunteer, whereas zone sponsors in the department have a more active and discretionary role. We step up and say, we want to do this thing. The zone sponsors actually compete. So to the extent not already required by law, we're making it clear that those of us who elect to participate will do the work that comes along. So, for instance, a place where it's not required of assessors or the Department of Revenue to do a piece of work is in documenting employment increases. They don't have anything to do with employment per se, so we're saying that responsibility should fall on the zone sponsors. It would be up to them to document employment increases and not the assessors. That's a change that's kind of woven throughout, but mostly it comes up in this section 21, well, the section on management of enterprise zone, which is broader than section 21.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Ask questions to go along.
Sure.
When you say that changed the responsibility for the documentation, what does that really mean as far as burden and cost and expense, that kind of thing?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, it's what we're trying to do is put the burden and cost with the people who volunteer to undertake an enterprise zone, who compete to have a zone designated in their neighborhood and move it off of the assessors and Department of Revenue who are required to undertake actions related to the tax. They need to find that the property is exempt, for instance. They need to establish what the amount is that's on the tax roll. They need to do that and will continue to do that. But everything else will fall to the people who've raised their hands and volunteered to pursue this. So there is some cost. There is some staffing. On the way over here, we were talking about the burden on the state for the Enterprise Zone program. And just off the top of our heads, our guess is there's probably less than one full-time equivalent in all of state government dedicated to this activity. There is work at the local level helping businesses walk through the process, helping businesses certify. For instance, in the case of an expansion of a business, in order to earn the exemption, you have to add at least 10% employment. That documentation, we're saying, should fall to the zone sponsors, the business and the zone sponsors who benefit from it, and not the assessors and or Department of Revenue who are essentially unwilling participants.
How would that actually function? Because if the person who's putting in for it has to prove it. I mean, so they just fill out a form and they say, we've done it, and then it comes to the government to determine whether or not there needs to be an investigation to see if that is accurate. I mean, how does...
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. At this point, the most straightforward way to document changes in employment is to deliver it's form ES-202. I think it's Employment Security Form 202, but it's the payroll tax declaration that goes to First Revenue and then the Employment Department. But changes in payroll and employment are per firm are detailed on that form, and that form would be acceptable documentation of an increase in employment. We're saying that delivery of that form is not a responsibility of the assessors in this bill. We're saying that responsibility would fall to the business which is benefiting and the zone sponsor who's gone out of their way to entice the business to expand in their community.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have a question.
Sure.
Page 16, line 45, or any relevant publicly funded job training provider. Who are we talking about when we talk that we have to notify local community college? I mean, do we know who the job training providers are?
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos. The intention here is to the program started off as an incentive to employ individuals in distressed communities, and there was intended to be a preference that the people hired for the jobs that are created be residents of the zone. We have opinion from the Attorney General subsequent to that's unconstitutional, that the state can't limit employment to people who live in a certain area. It's not a prerogative of the state to do that. So we've actually long ago, Portland Development Commission came up with a mechanism to try to get to that end without requiring legally that employees be hired, be residents of the zone, and that was to use any qualified employment public employment provider or training provider as a, quote, first source of hire. So the employer would go to the community college, or more likely in most parts of the state it's the employment department, and list the jobs for which they're recruiting with that employer, and then make the jobs available to people who are referred by that provider.
Mike, if I may, Art Fish with the department for the record. I just note that the term is actually defined on page 12, line 10, and it does include the community colleges and these other groups that in each that the employment department and others have sort of in various parts of the state have grouped together and interface with the zone and some other programs that require these first source agreements with the business. So it's not just strictly enterprise zones.
So that the service provider under the Federal Workforce Investment Act can be the unemployment office, right? The local
Representative Gallegos, yes. In much of the state, because there's work associated with this, in much of the state, it sort of falls by default to the employment department.
I'll follow up on it too. Could be also be an entity like Work Systems Inc., who handles Multnomah, Washington, Tillamook.
Chair Smith, Representative March, that's correct. That was the original intent from PDC.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman,
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Burton, the reference you made earlier to a reservation enterprise zone, I'm not real clear on that, and would you mind just telling me what does that mean, and is there any consequence with the fact that we're dealing with sovereign nation?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. In the last legislature, a bill was passed that allowed for tribal entities meeting certain criteria, which basically add up to Umatilla Indian Reservation and Warm Springs, to qualify for and upon designation receive enterprise zone status. And it is specifically because of the sovereign nature of those entities that they sought the exemption. As sovereign entities, they are allowed under law to collect their own taxes as essentially municipal governments, sovereign, but providers of public services. They felt limited in their ability to tax and recover costs from for-profit businesses, since the for-profit businesses would also be taxed by the county, the city, or whatever entity that the business resided in. For instance, a business on the Warm Springs Reservation will be in either Jefferson or Wasco counties and would be subject to property taxation per county law. Might also be being taxed, or the desire was to enable the government of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs to tax that entity, but the potential for double taxation provided enough of a disincentive to locate a business and expand the business that nobody had done it. And Warm Springs specifically has never taxed non-tribal business. They don't tax tribal business either, but they've not taxed anybody because they didn't want to provide the disincentive, but the potential was enough of a barrier that they felt it was precluding economic development from taking place on the reservation. So the zone was created to allow them to offset the property taxes of the other taxing entities.
Thank you.
Okay, Chair Smith, members of the committee. I'm at my bullet point 6, which is on the top of page 18. Another creation of the last legislature was a characteristic of some enterprise zone called e-commerce, which allowed for a property tax credit to recover the cost of certain investments in electronic commerce. That legislature identified the limit at 4 e-commerce zones. We had a competitive round to award the 4 zones and had 13 applicants. While the department doesn't have a number in mind, we felt that it was probably relevant to eliminate the statutory restriction on the number of zones and would actually be looking for input from the legislature on whether or not we should change the number of zones.
Questions? questions on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is the right moment, but maybe at some point we should discuss what type of applicants those were. I mean, if we get into a discussion of increasing the number of zones.
Chair Smith, Representative March, we could give you a list of the
Maybe tomorrow. Too.
Yeah, we could do that.
All right.
Chair Smith, members of the committee. Now, the department has also proposed a number of amendments after conversations with the assessors and the Department of Revenue. Those have not appeared, to my knowledge, yet as amendments to the bill. I'm prepared to address them. I don't know if you've got them in front of you yet or not.
Did you? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I provided a copy of the draft amendments. They look like this. These have been submitted to Legislative Council, although we have not yet received LC drafts back.
So, Chair Smith, members of the committee, would it be your pleasure that I address those now, or would you like to wait until you have the...
I think we should address them now.
Okay.
And then if we have questions, we can...
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I wonder if I might ask one question related to the e-commerce zones. Like you just mentioned, I thought you said on page 18 there's a reference to the current cap of 4 that would be amended out. Could you just point that out?
Representative Smith, or Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, it is on line 2. There's a large blank.
Way up there.
Yeah. The very top.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But, Chair Smith, members of the committee, like I said, it's really complicated. It's hard to work your way through this thing.
It really is. Representative Hash, you had a question?
Thank you. Well, I just, the 13 applicants for these zones, were these just statewide or were they in those 4 designated zones?
Chair Smith, Representative Haas, they were statewide. We had a number of them from each part of the state.
Well, if I could follow up, Madam Chair, I think the intent of that legislation, the e-commerce enterprise zone, wasn't unlike a lot of the enterprise zone intent, was to, you know, not get e-commerce companies health center in Beaverton because they're there already, they're going to stay there, there are more spinning off there, but to get them in Burns or River, wherever, where they're not. I mean, that was the whole intent. So. I don't understand why we'd want to change that and just say anywhere in the state, because then all of a sudden nobody wants to go to Burns. They want to stay near Intel, whatever the reason might be.
Chair Smith, Representative Haas, that is a fundamental question that the legislature will be dealing with in this session, not just related to e-commerce, but related to enterprise zones in general. There is currently a statutory limit on the number of enterprise zones in the state. There are also limits on the area and geographic dispersion of any one particular zone. There is legislation that would increase the number of zones. We understand that there is interest in increasing the number of e-commerce zones. My assessment is that if we're trying to target the incentive to the most distressed parts of the state and create an offset to the cost of doing business from Burns, for instance, which was awarded an e-commerce zone as one of the 4, then this is a reason to be selective and discriminating. If we're looking to provide an advantage for Oregon communities relative to other states, Idaho, Nevada, there's not a large disincentive in my mind in having them available wherever anybody wants them. Mr. Fish and I have discussed an alternative to that question, not specifically related to e-commerce zones, but just in general about enterprise zones, what we call e-commerce light, which would be if you get unanimous consent of all of the taxing entities in a given locale, the 3-year basic enterprise zone exemption becomes automatic. You can just do it. But the point you raise is an important policy decision.
Yeah, it's a fundamental question in terms of just make Oregon an e-commerce zone. That'd be great. You know, we might get new business from abroad or from California, but then Burns no longer, there's no longer an incentive to go to Burns.
Chair Smith, Representative Hass, that's exactly the policy question.
If I might, Mike, Representative or Chair Smith, members of the committee, just to be clear, an e-commerce zone is an enterprise zone first. And so of the 13 applicants, they were all existing enterprise zones that sought an e-commerce sort of designation on top of that, which carried not just a little bit of expanded eligibility for e-commerce businesses, but also a very special tax credit.
Continue. Chair Smith, members of the committee, the next change is a substantive change, is one of those proposed amendments. It's on page 22. And it's specifically on line 28. And really just takes out a choice of language that's unique to the enterprise zone program and changes the basis for the determination to a piece of information that's already collected by the Department of Revenue and by assessors. So it's just a technical correction to reconcile language with what really goes on in the world. Okay. The next one is on... It starts on page 25 and includes 29 and 30, and it's about firms that are authorized but haven't used the exemption. What the bill would do is have them renew the authorization, so they'd have to reapply. Some firms, for a variety of reasons, aren't ready to move ahead with construction, but having pre-certified now sort of reserve presence, and the assessors don't know whether or not they've started construction. So this would say, if you're delayed for some reason, you haven't done it for 2 years, you have to come back around and remind them what's up and give them a heads up. The next one starts on page 27 and provides a mechanism wherein a firm would make a sizable investment in terms of productivity in order to stay competitive in the market, which might not result in an increase of employment, might even result in a reduction of employment. This is an issue that's facing more and more Oregon firms as they try to stay competitive in the market and deal with large investments. And currently, there's only a limited mechanism. They have to be very large investments under the current law in order to make an expansion without creating jobs. On page 29, there is another proposed amendment. Again, the language isn't in the bill, but those firms which are subject to wage standard information would have to update that. So if over time you were going to get a long-term exemption that was based on meeting 150% of average county wage, you'd have to make sure that was current data. It would have to remain exceptional pay.
Okay. Yes. Can I just ask you to give us the line numbers, because we're running through these pages?
Okay.
It makes it hard to eyeball where these things are at.
Okay.
Like on page 29.
Right. I'm finding it.
The bold part, I think.
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos. This particular one is on page 29, line 29. Hmm. And we would add language that says, and if the firm is subject to compensation requirement under section... It goes on to say, then pursuant to that statement, the applicable county average annual wage is updated to equal the then current level, notwithstanding the agreement. So on these proposed amendments, you don't have the language before you. That's why I was suggesting it might make sense.
They had the incorrect draft, too.
Well, there's two drafts. There's the one you're mentioning, your bullet numbers, and then they have ABC.
Yes.
Mike, Chair Smith, members of the committee, Representative Gallegos. Yeah, we're talking about this D here on that. And just to let you know, this section 34A.
You're on 9. He's on C. Okay.
No.
I'm on 10 and C.
Okay. But the subsection, the section 34A from line 22 to 45 on page 29 and then a little bit on the next slide is just this thing that he mentioned that the assessors would like, so that, you know, the sort of pre-certification or authorization applications that are kind of getting stale on the shelf get renewed once in a while, so we know whether to count them or bother with them. And this would be, the Amendment D would just be a the thing to make sure that that compensation requirement wasn't based on too ancient a data.
Yes.
Mr. Fisher, when it says resubmit, how burdensome is that? I mean, you said just kind of make sure if it's sitting on the shelf. That sounds like a note, but this says resubmit. So are we talking about going back through the whole process again?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, Representative Richardson, could I ask of you a line number?
Yes. Looking at page 29, line 30 and 31.
30 and 31, yes. Essentially, that would be that after 2 years, they give the assessor and the zone manager a letter of continuing interest, and then that sub B there then says that every 2 years after that, because zone can go on for 10 years, and we've had some of these that just never seemed, they never really want to go away. And so they would just resubmit a letter every 2 years. So I don't consider it very burdensome, and it's certainly not a redoing of the entire authorization application or anything.
If I may, the firm basically notifies the county that through the zone and the zone sponsor that they're going to undertake, they intend to undertake an action that will lead to an exemption that's qualified. They estimate the amount of investment that will be subject to that exemption and basically put people on notice what they have in mind. There's potentially large benefits from that, financial benefits from doing that. We don't consider it to be a significant burden to have to notify people. And as Mr. Fish says, having notified someone and then not moved ahead, you could have everybody's attention and have people tracking whether or not you've actually made the investment for a period of time. So it's just meant to make life easier for the assessors who don't necessarily know that they're watching this particular piece of property unless they're reminded.
And, Chair,
yes.
Can I follow up on that? Because previously you'd mentioned, and I apologize because I'm going on your bullet, which was number 8, that firms that were authorized who hadn't used the exemption must renew. My question is how burdensome, you're saying it's just a letter. They wouldn't, the city and all those parties would not have to go through any more additional expense. It's just a letter to just reconfirm.
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, that's correct. They would just probably resubmit the same letter on update the date. Unless plans have changed.
Okay.
But just to be sure, most of the applications that we get, probably, you know, 67%, companies do act on them very shortly. And so very few of them, either if they want to renew, would even have to bother with it. It's only for those that, you know, are serious, because the pre-certification authorization is an outstanding sort of claim to get the exemption. So it is important that it be properly maintained. And so it's been a burden for a lot of us to sort of keep track. Well, are they really going to go through? And in fact, a lot of them do go away, but most of them just, you know, it's done in 2 years easily.
Okay. Chair Smith, members of the committee, I wasn't going to talk about the amendments. So originally they weren't in my bullet points because I didn't know the status of them. So I added them. From now on, I'll try it, and more than doubled the number of bullets that I was going to address when I put the amendments in. From now on, I will refer to my numerical system, the letter of the amendment, and we'll get you to the page and line, recognizing that the amendments aren't in the bill, so there is no really meaningful page and line. My bullet point number 11 is Amendment D and is on page 30, lines 25, 26, and And this is one I couldn't show you the language even if I wanted to, because we've asked legislative counsel to come up with an elegant way of saying this. But the intention is get to the specific piece of the investment that will be exempted. Only new investments are exempted under the enterprise zone law. So it's important to figure out, if you're remodeling a building, which part of the building is the relevant part that will be exempted. My bullet point 12, is on page 30 and is amendment E. But there are some you've got a different sheet than I do.
Okay, so this is on F.
He may have the older one.
Yeah, mine doesn't have the 24th on it.
I was doing really well until Representative Gallegos brought this along.
Okay, yeah, I was doing well, too.
I like the wrong ones.
I suggest when we do get the amendments, we have them all printed and then, you know, deal with the bill after it's printed.
Sheriff Smith, Representative Marks. That's kind of where I thought we might be going. But okay, I will refer to Mr. Fish's new lettered example. But there are some improvements to the land that we were not aware were also taxable. For instance, infrastructure that's pipe can be taxable. And so we had removed that when we cleaned up. This is the kind of thing we encountered last time when we cleaned up and simplified the law. We'd removed that, and indeed we find that it should be exempted. So we're putting that back in, or the amendment would propose that we put that back in. My bullet point number 13 is on pages 33 and 34, but essentially establishes a minimum threshold for building improvements. If building improvements were less than $50,000, they would not be subject to exemption. Number 14 on page 34, item H on Mr. Fish's list is was written in the bill to have our department adopt rules that would define an item of property. Conversations with the Department of Revenue indicate that they would prefer to do that. We would also prefer to do that. So we're proposing that responsibility go back to the Department of Revenue. Number 15. This is on page 34 and 36, or through 36, and is again a product of, or an evolution of a piece that came up, a correction that came up in the last legislature. But for very large pieces of equipment that have been idle, this would allow for an exemption if a firm invests, refurbishes that equipment, and puts it back in service. Pages 42 and 43, item I on Mr. Fish's amendment sheet, there is a deadline for certain tax filings to take place by August 31st. We were going to allow the firms until August 31st to make those filings. We're notified by the Department of Revenue that they need to take an action prior to that date and relay the information to the county assessor, so it doesn't work for them to move the deadline to August 31st. So we're proposing to take that change out of the bill and go back to the June 1st deadline to now allow Revenue to do their piece of work and get it to the county assessors.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Richardson.
Ms. Burton, when you mentioned that we're now at $50,000 or more, I'm looking on page 33, line 37 through 39. It says, in order for property to be qualified property, an item of property must cost $50,000 or more. And that's an item, so it's per property. I'm not clear what it is presently without this amendment. What does it take now to qualify?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, Representative Richardson. Currently, the law specifies that a building or structure individually must cost at least $25,000. The overall investment itself must cost $25,000. So this would increase the sort of minimum threshold for a building, and that would be your main minimum, if you will, in addition to the personal property thresholds. So you have, basically, it would all be per thing. The amendment that's been suggested through the assessors to sort of refine this even further, which is part of G, Amendment G on page 2 of the draft amendments, would just say that, would more simply say that it's $50,000 total for real property. Real property includes building structures and very, very heavy equipment. And so that would be just an overall minimum as opposed to the current $25,000 per building, which would be $50,000 here. And then the $1,000 and the $50,000 per item of personal property are just like they are in the current statutes. So we basically, except for that $1,000 thing, everything would be $50,000. As far as an item of personal property, real property, and then this thing that he mentioned about major refurbishment of a real piece of property.
Follow up?
Yes.
So is the reason because there's been complaints that that this has been abused, or is it kind of inflation? I mean, just trying to understand why.
I would say inflation plays a part because this hasn't been updated in 12 years, but I think it's mainly designed to simplify the language so that we're not dealing with too many different dollar figures, and it should be a little easier to communicate. Mike was referring earlier to our bill last session where we had a little more radical approach to simplifying these numbers, but that had, of course, a potential revenue impact. So we can't go much further than what we're proposing here as far as simplification in this respect. But it should help. It should help immensely, because then you can just count on your hands what the little thresholds are, which is kind of one.
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, this is an example, as Mr. Fish mentioned, this is a place where we tried to simplify things last time. We just basically said on personal property, just tell us what it is, there won't be a limit. And it turned out that was exempting a lot of stuff. And I say this is an example of the choices that will be made if we try to simplify the statute, because raising the limit to $50,000 does simplify administration. It does make it easier. Everybody knows what the threshold is. Nobody has to remember. On the other hand, there's a bunch of stuff that falls off the list because you went from $25,000 to $50,000. So simplification can make life easier for people, including the businesses, but it also potentially reduces the incentive for businesses. So it's that kind of trade-off that we get to when we talk about substantive simplification of the bill.
Really, that's why I'm asking the question, because I just want to be sure that we don't exclude smaller businesses that, you know, would no longer be able to do it. And I don't know how frequent that is.
That's Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. It would be big. I mean, the lower the threshold that you're moving, the more frequent the investment would become an issue. And my thought is that in the interim, we sit down and look at the potential impacts of those kinds of changes and bring to you, instead of making a decision on picking a magic number that would be the threshold, bring to you the trade-offs. And, you know, if we do this, if we change this limit to from $25,000 to $50,000, try to estimate how many businesses would be affected, and Or to put it another way, how many exemptions would be processed, how much work that would fall to the assessors by virtue of doing that, and have you decide, make the policy question, is the incentive worth the administrative work on the government side? Because it's a trade-off.
Yeah. But I'd just add for the committee that just focusing on this particular issue, it's pretty hard to build much of a structure for less than, you know, 10, you know, 50, 25,000. So in terms of the real effect here, in terms of rounding these things together, I would say we probably see maybe two or three investments every few years that fall in between 25 and 50, and they're mostly just add-ons. So, or they're just groups of some personal property. So I would argue, I would expect that there would be really little actual impact because this is mainly applied to buildings and structures, which I think when they're in play, you're looking at least hundreds of thousands of dollars, which in themselves only amount to, you know, $100,000 is only going to be, what, about a $1,500 tax issue anyway. So, you know, it's not going to be we're still dealing with very small investments in reality, even at the $50,000.
Thank you, Representative March.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, like, we're talking an item of property here earlier, and of course we're applying to both small city business investment descriptions and enterprise zones, I think. Let's see, the definitions. Okay. Often people talk about an improvement rather than an item of property. And so would, for example, construction of a new settling pond, it's not an item of property, it's an improvement. If it would cost over $50,000, does it qualify here?
Well, I get calls like that. Representative Smith, members of the committee, Representative March. My guess would be that it actually would, because a settling pond would be a structure. Okay. What's not covered under the enterprise zone now is land, and we had to make sure we weren't getting too carried away there, as Mike mentioned a little before, with utilities and so forth. But anything that's valued to the land would be not exempted anyway. Currently isn't, and all things on the land account remain taxable. But something like what you're mentioning, I'm not an county assessor. There may be one in the room or an evaluator, but I would imagine that would fall under a yard improvement or a structural type of thing that if it did cost $50,000, which it very well likely could, would be covered if it was part of an investment with the job creation and so forth.
Thank you. Chair Smith, Representing March. I didn't want to guess because this is one of those things that we thought was part of the land and therefore not subject to an exemption. And I would guess the same way Art did, and assume that this would be considered a utility improvement, would become then part of the real property, and would be exempt if the amount were over, if the total investment were over $50,000. I mean, as part of a real property improvement, would be a building improvement essentially, and would be part of that $50,000 building improvement threshold. But I'm just guessing on that.
To follow up on that, then, would that be the assessor making that determination?
Chair Smith.
Right.
The assessors make that determination.
Yeah, and the line, even as we are sitting here guessing, the real answer is would be very clear cut.
Right.
They would have procedures for that, and the cost number is just based on the cost the company says. So the valuation could be less or more,
sure.
In reality.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, two to go. Number 17 on my list is number J. No. Yes, it is. It is J.
Mm-hmm.
There are some special conditions that may be addressed or added by some zone sponsors, and we're trying to make it clear that that is not a responsibility of the assessor. The assessor doesn't have to document those conditions, but once again, the business and the sponsor would have to do that.
And just to clarify, this isn't really changing anything that legislative council or we thought. It just makes absolutely clear that that particular section, 34A, is among those various things to be sure that the assessor need not concern themselves with, short of a sponsor determination that their local conditions have not been satisfied.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I had one more under the enterprise zones proper and then had construction in progress listed separately on my list. Number 18 is basically an activity requirement for zones. We've had some zones that there are only 47 allowed under law. Some of them have not been active. We're saying that if you're not active for 6 years, and for new zones, for future designations, not existing ones, we're not going to change the rules on people already in place, but if you don't use it, you lose it, and it comes back into the pool and can be redesignated. A couple of pieces related to the long-term rural. There was a kind of a voice amendment to a bill in the last session that tried to recognize that in very rural parts of the states, a big deal is a different deal. These are exceptional exemptions for very large investments. And sort of very large was defined on a sliding scale because it's one thing in Lakeview and it's another thing in Portland. Portland was $100 million and basically a strategic investment program. We're not talking about that, so I'll stop talking about it. We'll get there maybe next time. But the intention was to recognize that remoteness could be a characteristic. So this $25 million floor was attached to things and created a situation that actually penalized very remote zones, and we're trying to take that out. We don't believe it was the intention, so we would take it out of the bill. And on very remote zones, whatever was the most favorable treatment would apply to those zones. The other thing, item number two on this short list, is the other purpose for this legislation from our perspective. There is a sunset on the long-term rural enterprise zone exemption, which is 2004. Because of the state of the economy, this is a provision that has essentially not been proven. There's been one exemption awarded under this statute, and we would like to extend the sunset, hopefully including an expansionary period, and find out if this is a compelling incentive for businesses. So we're asking that the sunset be extended for the long-term rural zone. It's page 54. The construction in progress.
Oh, Mike. Yes. If I may. Chair Smith, members of the committee, also on page 52, lines 40 and 43, is an insertion, and this is in the regular bill, of course, from the county assessors and others that we were talking with last year, that with respect to this exemption, that we also make it more like the short-term exemption in that it does not cover land or existing property value. It's a pretty straightforward method here to do that on page 52 at the bottom, but this while reducing the quality of the potential benefit for a company, really is in line with standard property tax methods, and we think doesn't meaningfully lessen the value, since these companies will be spending probably far more in other areas than in land in the average situation. So this has come to you from us through the county assessors as a request to make it, to kind of clean up the policy here.
The last piece, which is also addressed in an amendment, a long, lengthy amendment, or two amendments, K and L, is to provide consistent treatment of the construction in progress exemption, which is not properly an enterprise zone exemption, but there are essentially most businesses, most non-retail businesses are allowed to not pay property taxes while they're building their facility until the facility is usable and can generate income. And then that would dovetail with an enterprise zone exemption in an enterprise zone. We're proposing that for one of those exceptions, the construction in progress exemption be modified so that the firm would receive a construction in progress exemption and then roll into the enterprise zone exemption. And that exception would be qualified enterprise zone firms that otherwise wouldn't qualify for the construction in progress. And it has to do with, it's not simple, it says property, right?
Well, the amendment would make it much simpler, members of the committee. Chair Smith, members of the committee. Originally, our proposal on page 55 of the bill, line, 7 through 16, would provide, well, line 7 through 16 just reiterate that if you can't get this construction and process exemption, and it applies anywhere in the state, if you're a non-manufacturing facility that takes less than 12 months to build. Don't know why, but it is.
That's in the law.
That's also in the law. And we were going to provide, or the bill would have said in line 17 to 19 of page 55, that in an enterprise zone, you need not worry about that, because in the enterprise zone we have a lot of very major but, quote, non-manufacturing facilities. They might, you know, how many of them would ever really take less than a year to build, I don't know. But you get into distribution centers, software development, other things that are not manufacturing. And this would avoid us having to, you know, because it's easy to forget. It's one of those things that, you know, everyone admits it's easy to forget about. And if you're talking with an enterprise-owned company, it's pretty hard. You know, we try to present this construction process as part of the deal, less certain exceptions, like the 12-month thing, and that you can't use it if your utility property centrally assessed. So that was the point here. But the tax administrators felt, and when I say tax administrators, I mean both the department and county assessors, felt that to really try to mess around with the construction with these statutes was not worthwhile just for these purposes. And so the amendments, which we were quite happy with the suggestion, would essentially take this language out, leave commercial facilities and thing, and then just create a sort of a mirror image equivalent that would just work very well, much more smoothly within the context of the enterprise zones. And so we'd stick this language here on page 3 and 4 of the draft, right in the middle of the enterprise zones, to sort of span that point between when the company is authorized under construction but before they start the regular exemption in the enterprise zone. So that in a nutshell is what we were thinking of in the current bill language, and then what the amendment would do, which would be a little more involved method of doing the same thing. But then there's section 34C there. That's a little more.
So is that complicated enough?
Yes.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I think what we're saying is for qualified businesses within one small little section, they would get a construction in progress that they might otherwise not get.
Okay.
It's non-manufacturing, but they would be among these major investments that have been identified as being eligible for the enterprise zone exemption. So, as Mr. Fish points out, they would be wholesale distribution or call centers, certain class of businesses that otherwise would not be eligible for this benefit.
All right.
That's our enterprise zone proposal for you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
On the extending the sunset on the long-term rural enterprise zone, now, have you done a study after 10 years or a report that shows here's how many jobs created for the companies, here's how much money has in effect been exempted, or I guess it would be a tax expenditure, so that we can kind of see what we're buying or what we've paid for over the last 10 years? Is that possible?
Chair Smith, Representative Hess, there's only been one exemption, and I can give you a report on that. It was a $70 million investment or collection of investments made by Roseburg Forest Products near Riddle. The benefit so far has been one property tax year, $548,000 in savings. The company has not yet filed for an income tax credit, which was also approved to go along with that. So at this point, one $70 million investment and $500,000 in exempted taxes. It's too early to really tell.
Yes.
Since 95?
I can give you. This began in 1997. It was Chair Smith, members of the committee, Representative Haas. This began with this is the so-called DUCOR bill. It was designed somewhat more restricted than it became, but we did get it done so that it could be used elsewhere. But it was originally passed with the idea that it would be especially amenable to what the Nucor Steel Corporation would like if they were to invest in the Coos Bay area. That project fell mainly for land issues, I guess. In 1999, however, we worked with a number of legislators to make this even more applicable on a statewide level, reducing some of the requirements for a facility to qualify such that they were even more sensitive to local reality as far as what was big and what was significant. So really, since the 1999 laws have been in effect, has this been really usable. And unfortunately, some of these areas are at their least likely to attract such a facility during economically depressed times. And so that's kind of what we've had for much of the time since 1999. But as we did get the Roseburg Forest Products plant in Riddle, with this that, I think has been very well received. And we worked with the legislature on some very small issues related to that to make sure that it was doable even under the old Nucor legislation.
Madam Chair, what was the Roseburg? Was that another?
That was the one he mentioned, the 70 jobs and about $500,000 a year right now in terms of exempted or in terms of property.
Was that a mill?
What kind of job?
Yes, that is a engineered wood products facility. They make huge laminated beams and so forth through forest products. But it's quite a facility.
So to reiterate, the point of extending the sunset is to see in hopefully a flat or expansionary economic circumstances whether or not the incentive has value to very distressed parts of the state. That there is currently a twofold threshold for receiving, it's not authority, but for qualifying for going beyond the normal enterprise zone exemption. And if a county has extremely high unemployment and low per capita income, given some formula thresholds, the enterprise zones in that county can qualify for this exemption. And ideally, that would become an incentive that would induce very large investments, very large being defined on a sliding scale, different from Lakeview than in Portland. Portland's a bad example because this program's not actually eligible in Portland, but the point remains. And we've not seen those investments take place with the exception of this one. So we can't say if it works. We're proposing to extend the sunset and see if we can incent some development out there.
But it does make a difference in some discussions with some companies. So it's not, it has a...
We have expressed interest. There are firms that have told us that this would be a compelling feature for them. They've not yet gone ahead with their investments.
I guess to belabor this one second, question is, would that investment had been made about this? Right. I mean, they're based in Roseburg. Based on that.
Chair Smith, Representative Haas. You can never say for sure, or at least most of the time you can never say for sure. I am aware of some enterprise zone investments, Precision Castparts, for instance, did not pursue an expansion in Milwaukee. And specifically told us that they needed an enterprise zone exemption in order to do that. Instead, located the plant in the Tri-Cities area, and then came back to us with the same message. Milwaukee now has an enterprise zone, and that expansion took place in Milwaukee. I believe that there was a very clear connection in that one. I believe that that the enterprise zone in general is a useful tool that does make a difference. And I think the long-term rural exemption is a huge incentive and should make some decisions make sense that might otherwise not.
Yeah, but Chair Smith, members of the committee, Representative Haas, I wouldn't lose sight of the fact that the regular 3-5 continues to be a fairly compelling exemption. I'm sure there are many cases where companies, that was a very important critical message that kept them looking at an area. Obviously, the final decision will depend on other factors as well. So that remains very true. And locally, some areas are maybe not interested in growing the long term because they know that the short term is good enough, and that's their call. With respect to Roseburg Forest Products and their plant, I can only voice what they would tell us, which is that, you know, that was a very, it's a very risky thing to do right now or in this time. You know, forest products industries are not big investors in the recent times, and that they're looking at that and at the time and may still be looking at possible other connected investments in Southwest Oregon. So they were looking at a pretty long picture in which this made it much very, very possible. And I think locally people would say that they felt this was well worth the gambit that they got this.
Chair Smith, Representative Haas, at the risk of belaboring this additionally, I would point out that on the long-term rural exemption, both the extended property tax exemption and the income tax exemption, which was approved in this case, are discretionary and negotiable. So in this case, Douglas County negotiated a 15-year property tax exemption, and Governor Kitzhaber approved an income tax credit to go with that. Unlike the regular enterprise zone program, it's not an automatic thing. So there is local discretion, and people are making real choices.
Thank you. Not to belabor the question, but you're changing it, the sunset, to 2006 in this proposed amendment. Why not longer?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, we'd be happy to extend it or even eliminate it if that was your preference.
So a repeal or just a eliminate the sunset would be enough.
Chair, members of the committee, don't you want to see us back here in 2 years?
Sure.
Absolutely.
I'm just trying to address some of these issues.
Chair Smith, last time in the last session, we also extended the sunset and at that time suggested repealing it. We're granted a 2-year extension of the sunset, so we're going with the flow. But whatever works for you works for us.
Well, any other questions on this? Okay, that was it? Yeah, you're all done?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, it's not as bad as it looks. Most of this is simply taking pieces out from here and putting them back in here. We believe that this produces a really positive improvement in the program because you'll be able to sit down with the statute, go to the place you need to go to find the answer, and find it. We are aware of a number of other enterprise zone legislation bills. We would strongly encourage that. If you choose to advance this bill, you pick the right place to insert the new legislation as it comes forward so that tax assessors, tax administrators at the Department of Revenue, and businesses can just pick up the statute and look and find the place they need to look instead of having to read through 20 pages of statute to find something that's tucked away in a corner.
Yes, Chair Smith, members of the committee, I would further note with the organization, of course, we have some deletions and stuff, in many ways the text in what would appear in the statutes would be much more accessible, penetrable to the layperson, and even though it's not part of the official legal law, the subtitles and so forth that Legislative Council has proposed here would be very helpful to a lot of people that know the general subjects. They just don't have, for instance, mine or the AG's familiarity with, you know, how to do cross-references and so forth. Most of the cross-references that would remain would be literally just a page away at most. So that's, you know, it makes things a lot simpler. And there are certainly other details of procedures and administration in the chart that we prepared that Mr. Burton didn't go into, but they certainly make for excellent reading, as he said, what, fine phraseology or whatever? I mean, you know, but it is hopeful stuff, and I do believe this bill will also be heard by the Revenue Committee, and they also have a, you know, they also get into some of these other issues in other ways, too. So.
Well, thank you. In your estimation, then, this makes it simpler to implement and exercise and to read.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, that's our agenda for this bill. Is one, to make it simpler, be able to look things up where they belong, to extend that sunset.
Well, simpler would be nice.
Simpler would be.
Does it create any jobs?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I believe that this is a powerful and compelling incentive. I think the Enterprise Zone program is a program that makes a difference and does create jobs. When we did our overview for you a couple weeks ago, we brought the most recent listing or exemptions and jobs promised over the last year. And I can't remember, but there were thousands of jobs on that list.
Representative Smith, members of the committee, that's an excellent question. And at the beginning of my chart, we do summarize it. I say, and I was thinking about this, we say it can be more effective. And I don't know if that means more jobs, but it might mean fewer businesses that are otherwise qualified that for some reason get the wrong message or something. I think that would help. I think the one more substantive proposal for the short-term exemption is the one that comes to us from the Portland Development Commission, which Mike alluded to on, you might remember, it's the productivity, so that instead of having to invest $25 million or more, you can get local waiver to not increase your jobs if you have meet certain productivity and job training requirements, and that's on... it's on a page in here. I know that much.
It's the same problem.
But it would be under authorization. It comes under once they're authorized.
Pages 27, 28, 36, and 37.
He's trying to make the case for
Yeah, it's page 27, sections 33 and 33A. Or actually just section 33A contains this Portland thing. And that, in the types of cases where they're working with existing companies that have large workforces for which a 10% increase in employment is harder than it is if you only have 10 people or 20 people, 10% can be very difficult. And this would allow a local waiver, locally approved waiver, like the current one for $25 million or more. But instead of having to invest so much, you simply, or not so simply, increase productivity, and this is the thing that the assessors wanted to make sure they weren't going to have to deal with, but and some work training. And so that may be for some of our urban zones and other areas where we have larger existing employers, that may be quite helpful, because they certainly are trying to increase productivity. The idea may be that they can't add another 60 or 70 jobs in the process. And that would be 10% in many cases or more.
So. Chair Smith, members of the committee, I must be one of those lay minds that has a hard time grasping, finding things tucked away in the corners of the current statute. I've spent hours in here trying to find things for businesses, trying to track things down. In the last session, I found it much easier to turn to House Bill 2131 and crosswalk that back to the old statute to find the places I needed to find things. I think this is an important piece of work and strongly suggest you're moving the bill forward. And as I've suggested, we've tried to minimize the substantive changes. We're willing to work on those in the interim in order to bring you choices about what we could do to meaningfully simplify things for both businesses and the people who administer these programs and lay out for you the choices that would come with the impacts of those changes and choices. In this case, we, after talking to the stakeholders, elected to essentially not pursue substantive changes because we didn't want to get involved in the controversy that would come with them. We feel this is so important that we just want to shuffle the deck differently so people can use the program, find their way through it.
Thank you very much. Any other questions before I let these gentlemen go? Thank you very much, Mr. Burton and Mr. Fish. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on this? No one? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2299. In committee, we're set for Wednesday to hear the other part of this, the strategic investments program on Wednesday. Does anybody have any feel for... Because I don't think we're going to have amendments back, but maybe as we go through this.
You know, if they simplify this too much, we're liable to lose jobs. I mean, the consultants, the lawyers.
Okay. I don't think that's our goal.
Madam Chair, do you know who would be resistant to this?
If you'd like to ask Mr. Burton or Mr. Fish, we could. I'll just gavel back into our House bill. 2299, Mr. Burton.
Mr. Burton, who would be resistant to this? I mean, if you were us and we wanted to get a balance, and we've heard, you know, your position, who else should we be hearing from? Is there anyone that you could think of that would be, that would have an interest that would not be in favor of having this proceed at this point?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. When we came around with 2131 in our efforts to simplify things, we created significant revenue impacts for the taxing entities. The taxing entities, therefore, did not support that legislation. We spent time during the interim with the League of Oregon Cities and the special districts, who are keeping their eye on me from the back of the room here, making sure that I don't cross them on this thing. And I believe we've built a constituency around this that that basically covers the bases. I don't think, unless you were, you know, perhaps representing a business that stands to lose out on the exemption because we're changing some of those thresholds, I don't think there are very many. I'm not aware of anybody who's not okay with what we've got in this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? I'll close the House Bill 2299 public hearing. And committee, we will adjourn till Wednesday at 1. Close to committee.